Hi, Brian.
You. Can you?
I can hear you.
Hello?
Hi, Brian. Can you hear
me?
Hey,
how's it going?
Okay, good.
Yeah, I can hear you fine.
Cool.
So I confess, I've never used Skype actually just calling someone. I feel like, or last time I used it was years and years ago, so I wasn't sure if this would work the first time around.
It seems okay.
Okay.
I can't tell if we have a tiny time lag, but it's nothing too bad.
Okay. Well, if it gets too bad, let me know, and I guess we could try calling each other again or something like that.
Sure. But I think we're good to go. If you have any questions, let her rip. Otherwise, we'll just get started.
Well, no. I mean, I appreciate you reaching out to me. I'm just curious, what made you start reaching out to alumni wanting to interview them?
You got 5 minutes?
Yeah, I got the next hour or so blocked off for you, so let's do it.
It's a multidimensional answer. So one thing is, let's say in the fall of 2015, I was converted from part-time faculty to full-time. And we need, as full-time faculty, we have to do a, quote, service to the profession. Call it research or presenting stuff, etc. So that's like, okay, got to do something. And that's like, okay, well, what can I do that somebody, what can I study that somebody with a PhD in economics who's at Harvard can't?
Got it.
And I'm like, okay, I can study Berkeley alumni, and the Berkeley Alumni Office has been really following and doing a lot with, the music, let's say the people who are in music.
Sure.
But I'm like, there's been, in all the years of Berkeley, nobody has studied the people who are outside of music, and they account for roughly a third of the graduates.
Yeah.
So I'm like, here's something that I can do that someone at Harvard can't. I'm going to, get a lot of, fresh, undiscovered territory. And I also feel like I'm building something of value that I'm, I don't know if you saw, it's building a library. Here's something like my 80th interview.
So, yeah, I started looking at that, and that is pretty extensive. So, okay, that's cool.
Gives, let's say, people later in their Berkeley education and, even alumni someplace to look. Because, it's one thing to be, if someone's saying, hey, maybe I'll be a computer programmer and there's some book. But it's another thing if you can actually see, like, oh, look, here's some Berkeley grads who are doing it.
Absolutely. No, I dig it. I appreciate that perspective. I was just curious before we started just because, it was kind of random hearing from you, but I appreciate the outreach.
It's kind of how it always is, right? Yeah. I mean, I could say from my perspective, not random. I have a big, long list of people I could contact, but yeah.
Right. But we never had a class together or anything, I guess is what I meant.
No, absolutely. I pay for like the professional version of LinkedIn so I can put in all these search keyword criteria.
Got it. Cool. Well, yeah, here to help. I'm not sure if you have a certain format or anything, but
I do.
Okay.
So, if you're ready, we'll just get started.
Okay.
Oh,
perfect.
Format, I ask questions, you answer them.
Simple enough.
Yeah, all right. So let's start with your year of graduation, and if it was like spring, fall, and your major.
Yeah, so I graduated in the middle, and sorry, I don't know if it's on your end or mine. I hear static on the line.
Okay, I think I know what that is. Hold on just a sec. It should be better now. Alright, we're good.
Okay. Static's gone. You sound a little bit distant on audio, but the static is definitely gone.
Okay. Sorry. Let's just go forward.
Okay. You had asked me about your graduated.
And major.
Yeah, so I graduated, I guess, technically in the fall semester of 2009. So I think I received my degree in 2010. So I basically was halfway through the year. I needed to finish up some units. And I did the dual major program. So music business with a concentration on management, I guess the management track. And then I also did music performance.
Oh, very nice. Two very different majors, but I know some people who've done those two.
Extremely tough to juggle. I'm not sure if they've changed their tracks, but hindsight, I might recommend. I think they had I forget what they called it. It was a major that had a lot of the flexibility in it, and I forget
what
it was. Exactly, that's it. I would probably recommend that, because towards the end, it definitely was a lot to juggle.
Sure. By the way, what was your principal instrument?
Guitar.
Very nice. All right, well, we'll get to your history later. But
okay.
For now, tell us about your current job. What do you do? Where do you do it?
Yeah, so I'm on my third year here at a company called Proofpoint. Proofpoint is really a top five publicly traded cybersecurity company. So we specialize in protecting companies, organizations, and their people from security and compliance risks. So if you hear the news headlines, I think last week or a little over a week ago, we had the largest cyber attack ever recorded.
Thing that would like blackmail people.
Yeah, it's called ransomware. WannaCry was the actual name of the ransomware, and I think the name is these attackers like to be funny with their names. So if you get it, you're probably gonna want to cry. But we were actually in the news for that. So we were one of the organizations that helped identify it and ultimately stop it. So it's certainly exciting. We are when I started 3 years ago, we were about 800 people. Mm-hmm. A year from there, 1,200. I think today we're standing at a little over 1,700, projected to reach about 2,000 people by the end of the year. And I think our revenue is somewhere around the 2016 revenue was, I believe, $375 million.
That's a lot. That's a pretty big number. And it's an American company, I assume.
Yeah, headquartered in Sunnyvale, California.
Cool. I forget. Are you in the California?
Yeah, I'm live just south of Sunnyvale, so I'm at their headquarters, and I'm actually part of their commercial sales team. So I'm an enterprise account executive, and have a geography based territory that I've been working, and I focus on, as the name suggests, our commercial accounts.
And the large ones, it sounds like, if you're enterprise.
Yeah, enterprise, meaning we're talking thousands of licenses. Anything below 1,000, in fact, goes to our small and medium business unit. So the lowest that I would even work with are organizations that would buy 1,000 units.
Like to cover 1,000 laptop computers.
Yeah. I mean, more specifically, we have a software licensing model, mm-hmm. and I'll give you a really good example. A kind of odd scenario would be retail, where perhaps you're not going to give someone who stocks the shelves necessarily an email address. So at the end of the day, it's the number of units that we're moving. So you get a big range of organizations that have over 10,000 people and maybe only need, 4,000 units. And then you have, tech, manufacturing, et cetera, who might be one-to-one. But the idea is, these are organizations that have user counts in the thousands and often employees of even more.
Do you mind sharing, I'm sure it varies a little bit, but just kind of ballpark, how big are the deals in terms of revenue for your company?
The ones that I work on are six figures in nature. I would say high end for software alone would be 200,000+. And I suppose a low end threshold would be roughly 80,000.
Gotcha. Is this a 1 year thing?
It doesn't have to be. Most common is a yearly subscription model, but we can extend terms beyond. I know some organizations like that. Sometimes they'll get a benefit from doing that. Granted, we do have what we call strategic account managers, and you know, it just goes higher and higher. And you know, I cover roughly 80 to 100 accounts. We have some account managers who only cover five, but they're, you know, some of the largest retail organizations in the world, or fruit companies and things like that, that really, that's all they do is service that one account. So it varies, and their deal sizes are in the millions.
Gotcha. Where is your territory, by the way?
What do you think? Yeah, beginning of the year, so almost 2 quarters ago, I actually transitioned to the greater Northeast area. So New York, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Pennsylvania.
Are you the one person responsible for that territory, or are you one of a number?
Yeah, absolutely not. I am one of many. I have a quote-unquote lane that I stick to, certain size of accounts. Mm-hmm. But I have coworkers that cover different verticals. So as I mentioned at the beginning of the call, I'm focused entirely on commercial, but we have account executives who do nothing but SLED, state and local government, education, finance, and we have healthcare verticalized reps as well.
Okay, so in other words, so you're like the only person doing the type of business that you're doing in that region, but other people are doing other types of businesses.
Correct.
Gotcha. Do you mind sharing, I'm not going to ask how much money they pay you, but do you mind sharing how your compensation is structured? Like, you know, some salespeople, it's all commission, some have a salary, some it's a combination.
Yeah. So for me, it's the comp is very simple. Just talking about compensation straight up from a salary perspective, it's 50% base and 50% accounts for your quota. And you can go above that, but a really simple scenario would be, and I'm just throwing numbers out there. If you have, you might have 50,000 base, and if you hit 100% of your quota, you get 50,000 in commissions to combine for 100,000.
Gotcha.
You certainly go over that, but that's essentially how Proofpoint does it.
Okay, yeah, I've heard of other software companies. The 50-50 split seems fairly common.
Yeah, it is, especially, it seems like, especially within software.
Yeah. Do you mind sharing what is your yearly quota?
Yeah, just for me, it is just a little bit more than $500,000. So these deals can take a while. They can take anywhere from 6 to 12 months. So my charter is to bring in a little over $500,000 each year.
And is that because I know some companies, a lot of what people get for sales are like old customers renewing, whereas some other places, all they care about is the new business you generate, and then it's out of your hands. Like, so is that $500,000 a new business, or is that includes?
Great question. I was trying to not necessarily go, you know, such a deep dive, but I'm happy to. So that's a good question. I am on the new logo team, so that's entirely new business. Everything I do is bringing new revenue to the company, so there's a premium on that. And once I fulfill that initial procurement cycle, it goes to our customer success team for just ongoing support and ultimately additional products. We have a pretty big portfolio.
Gotcha. So you do you mind sharing, like, if you're all about reaching out to those new customers, how do you do that?
It's a number of ways. So I'm fortunate enough to have a team around me. I have what is often sometimes called business development representative. And that, to be perfectly blunt, is someone whose sole job is to do outreach, dial, email, and try to set meetings for you. And you coach them, give them, strategize on how to get into an account. That's one avenue. The other avenue is me. I pick up the phone, I'll reach out, call, network, you know, email, etc. Another avenue is we work with what's referred to as the channel. The channel is, think of it as a distribution organizations. That distribution is actually simplifying it a little too much. There's organizations that, picture you're a large company and you have all these vendors approaching you saying, buy my stuff. Well, you might want to have some help with that in terms of fulfilling RFPs or just evaluating vendors. So a lot of times you will have a contact, and that distribution contact should, in a good scenario, provide value in terms of helping that customer in guidance and fulfilling whatever their requirement is. On the flip side, Proofpoint's made an organizational choice to do what we call 100% channel-centric sales. So every single sale we do needs to go through a channel partner. And there's two ways of looking at that from a macro sense. So the positive of that is that a lot of times we can leverage the channel as a force multiplier. So if I need an end to a company, we have partnerships, and feasibly some of those individuals could help open doors for me. No one works for free, so they certainly have a margin. We provide our product at a slightly discounted rate for their services, but that opens the door. So there's another avenue. The other avenue would be just networking events, marketing, of course, things of that nature. Inbound leads, outbound marketing, stuff like that.
Cool. I've heard some people in tech sales refer to there being like inside sales reps and field reps. Does your company do that, where it's like there's the one person who's always in the office on the phone, and then there's the other person who actually goes out to the company? And
Yeah, that's very common too. I'm on the inside commercial team. It depends on each organization. Some are very liberal with having you travel out to a particular territory. Some are very strict. Hey, you're inside, just stay there. Excuse me. I'm fortunate to have a lot of flexibility with being able to travel, but traditionally inside sales means what it says. It's inside. And we do have field executives too. And a really easy way of thinking about that, just from a high level, is inside reps typically service the medium to lower to medium enterprise size organizations. Field reps tend to go after the Fortune 100, Fortune 500. That doesn't mean I don't get to work with Fortune 500 organizations. It just means that theoretically a field account manager will be servicing an account that is slightly higher than I get to support.
Gotcha. And when you talk about there being higher and lower accounts, is there a sort of hierarchy in your company? In other words, like if you do well here, do you at some point get moved on to the bigger accounts?
Yeah. I mean, within even our inside team, there's four levels, and right now I'm at the fourth level, so there's really nowhere else for me to go at this
fourth
point.
Fourth meaning the highest.
Yeah, the highest. I'm a senior account executive, and the idea of that is I essentially call on the highest accounts that we can call on within our lane. But theoretically, a lot of organizations, in terms of ranking and their sales, if you're talking to recent college grads, a lot of them cut their teeth on being that BDR or business development representative. That is a great place to just cut your teeth in terms of outreach. In fact, right out of Berkeley, I did a lot of BDR type roles. And then you transition to a lot of small, medium business organizations, and then you just sort of start climbing the ladder. And each organization is different. So, the accounts that I get to call on, Proofpoint's a little different in that a lot of organizations would consider them larger. But we've just chosen to slice and dice in a certain way. I've spoken to other organizations who the accounts that I might support might go to field. It really just depends on how an organization wants to divide it.
And by the way, I was just doing a little bit of math between the deal size and your quota. So it sounds like you're doing maybe 5 deals a year.
Yeah, that's fair. 5. If you get a couple small ones and it's offset by a larger one, maybe 7.
Okay.
So when we sell our products, they affect organizations. They in a big way. Our primary. A lot of people know us as a secure email gateway provider, but we have a broader portfolio than that. And when you look at, boy, am I going to shift vendors to someone like Proofpoint, there's a lot of people who are involved in it. It could be information security teams, IT teams, compliance teams, eventually a CIO has to sign off, and potentially even board needing to sign off, depending on the expense. So these are long sales cycles. So yeah, it's not volume, at least where I'm there. It's what a lot of people would refer to as a complex sales cycle.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Hey, let's zoom in a little bit. And let's say not a day that you're signing a deal, but, you know, let's say your typical day at work. Could you just sort of take us through the whole day? Like, what fills your day?
Yeah, and I suppose that's the beauty of sales. I think the successful ones, and I've really been in sales ever since graduating, so I would say the successful ones are very good about organizing their day. So for me, I like to mix it up. I, as much as possible, want to be in front of a customer, whether that is what we call a discovery call or a demo of some sort or an educational-based call or eventually what we call an evaluation, and following that, eval check-ins. So a typical day in an ideal sense would be no day is exactly alike. It's not structured in that way, but every single day I want to do a number of things. Number one, I want to do new prospect outreach. Number two, I want to interface with my BDR and make sure that we're aligned. Number three, I want to be reaching out to organizations that I'm currently in a sales cycle with. Number four, I want to be kind of triaging and circling in and making sure that the corresponding channel manager who might be involved with that account is up to date on anything that might be happening. I also do a lot of self-education. If I have a slow day, I'm going to put an hour on my calendar to learn more about something. We have internal training as well that gets mixed in there. And
you talk about like learn more about your company's products.
Not so much that, more just the broader technology stack, the industry, self-education about competitors, maybe ask our SEs. So in addition to BDR, we're teamed up with system engineers. Ask them about certain use cases, if I have any questions.
Oh, and by the way, what's BDR stand for?
Business Development.
Oh, yeah, Business Development Representative. Yep, got it.
Yeah. So it's a mix of that. And the last one, of course, is internal. I call it admin work, and that is the essential process of quoting product and getting it approved and forecasting your upcoming quarter.
Gotcha. And
does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does. It does.
Okay, good.
And by the way, I'm sure it varies week to week, but about how many hours do you typically work in a week?
Some weeks it's more than 40 and some weeks it's less, but I try to put a good 40 in. There's some weeks that it's a little bit under, and some weeks I find myself at the office until, you know, after 6 o'clock. So it really varies.
Sure. Sure.
40 is a good target though. You know, 8 to 5 typically.
Mm-hmm. All right. So, hey, to do these interviews, one of the criteria, you may recall, was that you enjoy what you do.
Yeah.
Field. So, hey, I could hear that you're totally, like, in your element here, but I'd love if you could articulate for the listeners what is it about your field, or if you wish, your job, that you enjoy?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, you know, one of the things about sales that's really cool is it's really an opportunity to – I'm going to do the emotional. I'm going to appeal to your emotional sense, and I'm going to also appeal to your pocketbook or your the financial side.
Uh-huh.
It's a great opportunity to interact with organizations, learn about them, and essentially solve problems in a meaningful way depending on, you know, what you're doing and if you believe in it. And I do not recommend anybody getting into sales if they don't truly, truly believe in the product itself. I just don't think that's a good match. And it's also great to essentially be your own boss in some factor. You need to be in many organizations, not always. Some drive KPIs a lot more in terms of I expect 50 dials a day and stuff like that. But
what
at the end
KPI,
of the day,
what are KPIs?
They're key performance indicators. So, you know, if I know that we do well when a rep, you know, makes 50 dials a day, I want to make sure they do that, and I'm going to track that, that type of thing.
Gotcha.
But what I really like about sales is you really can drive it, right? You want to do more sales, put in more time, or get more strategic. You want to slack off, fine, but you're going to be, you know, compensated in that manner, theoretically. Mm-hmm. I always looked at it as a great opportunity to, number one, help people. But number two is also get – it's a very good way to get rewarded for your time in a way that potentially compensates you more than doing something else. And there's a risk reward there. A lot of times bases are a little bit lower than the market, but you have a potential to make higher than the typical earning power of some other position perhaps. So it's a way to – you know, maybe you're not a doctor, maybe you're not a lawyer, maybe you're not an accountant, but you can make doctor or lawyer type money or more in enterprise sales. And
I remember
that's...
my father. Sorry, go ahead. I was going to say my father had a high tech company, and let's say the typical deal was about $50,000, and this quota for salespeople was $1 million. And then 1 year, one person put together like a $4 million deal and made more money than anybody else at the company that year, including the president.
That is a realistic scenario. Absolutely. Yeah. They might be considered more of an outlier, but there are occasions where the stars align, whether it's a combination of hard work, luck, you know, whatever you want to call it. Where you can really you can really monetarily speaking make a lot of money. I don't think that necessarily should be the primary driver, because I think you'll burn yourself out. But there's certainly it's an avenue to be well compensated for the time you put into it.
Sure. Oh, great answer. All right, so hey, let's take it back now to, I think you said 2009 as you were finishing up at Berkeley. I mean, were you thinking software sales?
No. I mean, there was this big world event that happened around 2009 with, you know, the housing market collapsing.
The economy melting down, yeah.
Oh, man, I remember it vividly.
Before you go on, I was going to say, like, yeah, put us in your headspace back then, and we'll actually go, like, step by step all the way up to where you are now.
Yeah, well, you know, on this, I'll start with, on the side, I actually did sales. So I was, this isn't really too common. I was kind of towards the last wave of people who do this, but I was what's kind of referred to as a rep, a business rep, and without getting too deep into it, I had what was referred to as a line card. So I had offerings that I could sell from three different companies at the time.
You're saying as a Berkeley student.
Yeah, I was doing it on the side. It was one of those gigs where you want to talk about compensation. It was a gig where you get compensated for what you sell. Mm-hmm. And I loved it because it offered me some flexibility to do what I had to do from an education perspective, and it offered an avenue to be in sales, so and get compensated and help to not only address tuition but just, you know, living expenses. So I did have sales experience, but
hey, do you mind sharing, like, if while you were a Berkeley student, like, I know, obviously, as you said, you got paid for what you sold, and some days are going to be better than others. But do you mind sharing, you know, roughly what you were making per hour?
Oh, yeah. Gosh, I haven't thought about that in a long time. I would equate to each sale of being a couple hundred dollars, and I'd make maybe You know, it wasn't a lot. It was so I had short-term sales that amounted to a couple hundred dollars roughly per sale, and I might make one or two of those type sales a week. So it's hard to equate an hourly figure to that.
I mean, I'd just say, were you putting in maybe 20 hours a week or like 5 hours a week? Or...
Probably somewhere between 10 and 15.
Okay. So, if I'm doing the math right, 25-ish an hour, which is, you know, for a college job, very good.
Yeah, I mean, it was a chance to kind of be the master of my own destiny from a sales perspective and gain that flexibility and get exposed to just what's it like selling to companies. And I got what was referred to as the bad leads. So I would have all these veterans give me these lists of people who either had interacted with the company before and either fell off the face of the earth or never called back or anything like that. And I would simply just follow up with them when I could. And when I did, I'd get a hold of some of them. And sometimes that would turn around into a sale. So that's kind of how I did it. They kind of funneled me their quote unquote bad leads, and I would simply follow up with them.
Gotcha. Okay, so you're doing that in college, and then, as you say, the economy melts down, and you're finishing up Berkeley. Yeah, terrible timing.
Yeah, so, and just an FYI, I don't know if your microphone or something, they're that static returned, yeah, so just for your audio's sake, I want to give you a heads up. At the time, you know, it was different because at the time I thought I wanted to take the LSAT and also look at, you know, essentially going to law school. And I was fortunate enough to, I don't know if you still do it, but you had a partnership at the time with Harvard. It was their recording artist program. It was essentially an opportunity for a Berkeley student to work with a particular clinic at Harvard where they provided entertainment-based legal counsel or contract review. So they would do work-for-hire agreements, indemnification clauses, 365 deals, or 360 deals, rather. I do a lot of O365 business, sorry, so that figures in my mind. But it was an opportunity to kind of get exposed to just law in general. I thought I wanted to do that, but honestly wasn't sure. And I just made the personal choice that if you're not sure, that's fine. Maybe you should, you know, join the workforce for a little bit. I knew that I wasn't going to do music, at least from a playing perspective, as a profession. I wasn't going to become a studio musician. I wasn't going to, do it. Anything from a playing music perspective. And the most truthful way I could put it is before I went to Berkeley, I had this itch that I wanted to scratch. I didn't know a lot about music and I wanted to know it. And I didn't know what I was capable of. And in a very odd way, going to Berkeley alleviated me of that. I found out what I was capable of. I learned more than I ever, you know, dreamed I would learn about music in a very satisfying way. And I met individuals who were just amazing, some of the best musicians I've ever met. And that applies to the faculty and the students themselves. The easiest way to explain it is I was satisfied in my journey and the prospect of being on the road, and wasn't that appealing. And I knew I didn't want to necessarily teach for the rest of my life, you know, guitar lessons or something like that. But it was still gratifying. The best analogy that I've come up with is I had this thing I needed to achieve prior to going to Berkeley, and going there helped me to achieve it in a way that was very fulfilling, but also allowed me to frankly move on. And that's why I did the dual major program. So that's one component of it. And it was just one of those things where I was super thankful for the opportunity and support of even my family. But I just knew that you know, I knew I wasn't the greatest musician because I'd met colleagues or just classmates rather. And I knew that I didn't necessarily want to be practicing 6 to 8 hours a day, a craft. I got to the point that I personally wanted to be at and was satisfied in that and kind of was ready to move on to either taking what I learned at my time at Berklee, but really I was focused on the music business side of things. Mm-hmm. And trying to figure out how to get into quote unquote business. I know that's kind of a nebulous way to describe it, but I just knew I didn't want to, the instrument legit. Itself was more of a hobby.
No, perfectly legit. And you're not the first person who's answered it. I was just trying to, you know, get where you were at. So tell us about what was your job search process like for that first job after college?
It was actually challenging. It was pretty challenging just because of the economy, where things left off. And it was challenging on a number of fronts. It was challenging from the perspective of, well, frankly, I interviewed at Starbucks to be a barista while I was trying to just figure my stuff out, and I actually got rejected. Again, very weird time, but they flat out told me, you have 2 degrees, you're going to leave at the first chance you can. And frankly, they were right. So I didn't really fault them for that. So I kind of felt a little bit like I was in limbo because a lot of people were in this phase. People who had corporate jobs who just needed a job were kind of encroaching on more entry level type positions. So what I ultimately ended up doing, I was lucky and I fell back to, if you recall, I was quote unquote representing 3 different companies and one of those companies ended up taking me on full time.
You just spoke to the person you've been working with, like, hey, I'm looking, and they're like, okay.
Yeah. I mean, they knew a little bit of my work ethic and they were willing to essentially offer me an entry job in sales.
Gotcha. So, do you mind sharing, what were you selling?
So that particular job, it was a small software test and development organization that essentially looked at product mainly. They worked with a lot of telecom companies. Essentially, wrote software to make sure that the product itself was either manufactured properly, looking for essentially manufacturing defaults, opens, shorts, etc. When these products were made en masse. So when you think about a server or the equipment within a server, it could be worth thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars. So when you make it, you want to make sure that's built correctly. And there's a way to do that in an automated fashion. And that company, one area of expertise was writing that software and creating the actual mechanical models to enable that that product to be tested in a manufacturing environment.
Gotcha.
And actually, that was a really, really great part of just getting into sales because I had the opportunity to start entry level and get mentored by a few people and work up to working with some of the some pretty large organizations to be working with for the ratio of organization to my experience at the time. So I look back really fondly on that. And it was, again, a complex sale and not here. I was working with electrical engineers and, people who created product and manufacturing engineers. So I didn't quite know about it, but it did teach me, if you want to talk about sales from a high level perspective, know the value of the product. And know what you don't know. So I was very upfront with, I don't know that. But a good organization is going to empower a salesperson with resources. And that's all you got to know. So anybody out there thinking about getting into sales who might be afraid of, well, gosh, I don't know this or that. A good organization will empower you. You should never be on your own. You shouldn't be on an island. It should be a team event. So that's how I got through that.
Gotcha. How long were you there?
About 4.5 years, I want to say.
Gotcha.
So I really progressed from entry level to from a trust perspective, working my way up into being able to call on certain customers. And it was a really rewarding experience. But ultimately, and I was very open about it, wanting to transition into more of a larger company and cut my teeth there, and also wanting to get into software sales because, frankly, that's where I wanted to be. That's where a lot of stuff is happening. Hardware these days is becoming, at least in the B2B space, is becoming somewhat commoditized, and I wanted to be in software sales.
Gotcha. So at that point, you've been doing it for 4 years. So was this just, did you get your next job? Is your next job your current job?
It is, yeah.
Yes. How did you end up getting that job?
A combination of referral and mostly referral and just mentioning to a friend that, hey, I'm open to start, you know, expanding my horizons and looking for my next move. If you know of any organization that is currently hiring based on XYZ, I'd certainly love to talk with them. And they happen to work at Proofpoint and recommended me.
Cool. It sounds like when you start at Proofpoint, yeah, not as pretty a territory, or you were doing smaller accounts and then you sort of worked your way up to the scene.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Cool. All right, so here we are. Let's move on to the third part of the interview of three. So my first question for you is, these days, what, if anything, is your current relationship with music?
Yeah, good question. So unfortunately, the guitar stays in its case way too much. I obviously listen to music. I think anybody will listen to music. I use music as therapy now, though. I will use guitar as therapy. I don't have a goal of becoming this great this or that or wanting to teach. And I think, frankly, a lot of people after going to Berklee, at least from my perspective, a lot of people that I've spoken to, after you go through Berklee, you kind of lose the competitive thinking of, I want to be great or this or that. You learn there's a bunch of different types of music and performances, and there's just so much to appreciate in so many different levels of virtuosity. From, you know, you could have a very sloppy type guitar player that just will write the most amazing songs that you can appreciate, and then you could have, gosh, when I was at Berklee, some of the more like what I would consider intricate players that I would look up to from an alumni perspective, like John Scofield or Kurt Rosenwinkel, just would just blow me away. And I have a soft spot for the entire spectrum, even pop music. I think Berklee kind of taught me to appreciate rather than judge, I would say. Mm-hmm. And because of that, I really value my time, but in terms of where I am with music in my current life, it's more therapy than anything.
I'm sorry, just when you say therapy, are you referring to like playing your guitar or to listening to music?
Both, but mostly playing. I mean, listening to music is a constant in my life regardless of where I am, what I'm doing. But therapy being, you know, tough day at the office or just busy day, you sit down and you start playing guitar, it's almost a form of meditation, and you could be 2 hours gone into it really quickly. So, and just knowing, and this is a very odd way to put it, my dexterity is down. Gosh, that sometimes bothers me and bums me out, but I know if I really truly wanted to, I could pick it back up. But knowing that, it's a really empowering feeling to know if almost any song that you'd want to play, if you wanted to play it, you can do that. So a lot of times I'll be listening to a song, oh gosh, I want to play that, and I'll sound it out, you know, and just start working on it or something. Just having that, I guess, talent or ability. Sometimes my friends go, what the heck are you doing? You should be taking advantage of that more. But I just, for me as a person who I am, I just love being able to pick up the guitar, listen to something, map it out, or just play whatever chord progression, anything. And just it relaxes me. Mm-hmm. And so that's where I am with music. It's kind of long-winded.
No, that's very cool. There's no right or wrong answer. There really isn't. And you're not the first person who said something similar.
Yeah.
So, okay. So next question I have for you is, so thinking about your current job and, you know, your Berkeley experience, let's say relative to going to some other school, is there anything you feel your Berkeley experience did particularly well to prepare you for what you're doing now?
Yeah, actually, and it's kind of cheesy, but it's something that I truly believe in. So one thing that really resonates with me, to the extent that I'll even tell people this, the thing I learned about Berkeley, if you perform 90% of a song, you didn't perform the song. People are going to remember you messed up. You stopped halfway, you know, you stopped before you finished, or you stopped halfway through and you didn't do the song. It's binary. And I kind of take that into my thought process of going about business in terms of preparation and research and taking advantage of opportunities. So if you're doing 5 to 7 deals a year, for example, you better make sure that you give it your all, right? And you better make sure that you prepare. So, I think just having the work ethic of really taking, you know, less than 100% of a song is you haven't done the song. And I just, it kind of instilled this work ethic in me to be thorough and not half-ass anything, really. Don't necessarily coast. And that simple principle has helped me in a lot of areas of my life, actually. So that's the biggest, one of the bigger takeaways, I'd say.
Very cool. All right, well, hey, let's turn that question around now. Because Berkeley gives that one degree, a bachelor's in music degree, and you went there knowing it, and as you said, it was something you wanted to do at the time. And, you know, certainly you've had a very good sales career from everything you're saying so far. But thinking back to your Berkeley education, is there anything where you look back and you're like, hey, it would have been really useful to have learned this while I was at Berkeley, and they could have taught it to me, and they didn't? Anything missing or inadequate?
Yeah, I mean, when I was going, the music business track, it still seemed relatively new. I don't recall how.
You mean the major?
Yeah, the major, rather. Yeah, it still seemed relatively new. Mm-hmm. In terms of what I thought that they potentially could have done, I think maybe, and it's a hard question for me to answer just because of the circumstances around the timing, and I am referring to the recession, but maybe from my perspective, there weren't as, I didn't feel like there was this huge connection to business in the music business industry. All things considered, I thought they did a really good job. There was a little bit of difficulty in transitioning from Berkeley to a job. That's something that I remember having a tough time with, but it was also, I would attribute that to the timing of just what was happening in the world. The only other thing that I can really think
I'm just trying to clarify what you're saying. Were you saying that you felt like you learned about the music business, but you wish you'd learned more about regular business?
No. Sorry if I was unclear. I didn't feel like there was necessarily a really clear path. You might hear the concept of feeder schools from certain regular colleges and universities, certain feeder schools to certain organizations. Mm-hmm. I didn't feel at the time like there was a quote-unquote Berkeley feeder school, and the path wasn't that clear. Like, what happens if I wanted to work at, you know, Warner Music or, you know, Atlantic Records, which actually I think is part of Warner. What is a clear path or a quote unquote music industry large organization that kind of has their arms open wanting to hire Berklee students en masse?
Very direct guidance on the career.
Yeah. I mean, it was kind of nebulous, and frankly, it is what it is. I mean, I don't necessarily fault Berklee for that. It's just I'm thinking of paralleling that with another school or university, and a lot of them have their, you know, certain companies that tend to be feeder schools for organizations either within the area or within a particular industry or vertical.
Sure.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it totally does. Totally does.
And frankly, if that was there, if I did have that opportunity, I might be doing something completely different. But I was kind of in the role of, wanting to get a job. And then I started doing it full time and I found out that I really loved it. So it all worked out in the end. It's just that's something I remember having difficulty with. And I also can see that, again, there were kind of these economic forces that didn't make things much easier.
Yeah, no, it's always that much more impressive when a class of 09 or 2010 graduate lands on their feet.
For sure.
So, as you say, I mean, you were doing these sort of business-to-business sales while still a Berklee student. And as you say, even you'd figured out that you weren't going to try to be a working musician, but you wanted a day job.
Yeah.
And, you did manage to then get a job pretty quickly. But was it like pretty much right after college where you start working for this company, by the way?
No, it wasn't. It was probably 6 months. 6 months after, it took me about 6 months to kind of, get things together, flounder just a little bit. That I think is totally natural.
Yep.
And kind of go through just working it out, quote unquote, working it out, and interviewing, trying, going through the process of trying to find a job here or there, and ultimately reaching out to the people who I knew.
Gotcha. So, okay. Fairly painful 6 months, but you did manage to reach him, got on this track of, high-tech sales, realized later on you transitioned to software. Fairly minor jump, I'd say, as far as career changes go, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
So, point is, you've had a pretty straight path, a little awkwardness at the beginning. But, almost a linear progression for you were doing at Berklee to now. I'm sure you're aware that a lot of recent Berklee grads have not yet found their path.
Mm-hmm.
And there may even be people in their last year at Berklee staring out into the big scary world being like, oh my God, what next? So for either or both of those groups, what advice do you have?
Yeah, so I'd say number one, while you're at Berklee, and frankly, this is something that I even regret that I didn't do as much, because being music performance, I felt like there was just a lot of practice time. But take advantage of to the maximum, just meeting people there at Berklee and even around the area, and networking and developing this appreciation for everybody being there and being open to them and friendly and just basically networking. I'd say that's a good foundational principle to have, and taking advantage of anything that Berklee is offering around the area. If you can push the extra mile, I wrote very briefly for the Music Business Journal. I did the Harvard Recording Artist Program. I went on trips to – every now and then we go on trips to, like, New York together with certain groups. I mean, if you have the opportunity to do that, number one, do it. And I know there's school, and that's important, but there's also people, and I think the connections you make there can pay off in unexpected ways down the road. But let's say you've done that, you've graduated, and you're staring into the abyss, or you're still trying to figure it out. I mean, I guess my advice would be to simply – realize I would like to see, and I try to practice this myself, if anybody from Berkeley needs help, feel free to reach out to me. Excuse me, if there's something I can do to help,
that's
I always
nice.
Will.
I assume they could contact you via LinkedIn.
Yeah, they can find me on LinkedIn. That's perfect. But number one, I think it starts with each of us. So even those individuals that might be floundering, help one another, right? We're all in this together. We all came from the same university. So that's a really good place to start, is just networking and then building upon that in terms of wanting to help one another. Because you don't know, maybe you're floundering, but the person you know isn't, and they could help show you the path. And they can help open doors if you know each other and you ask for help. That's the other thing I was leading up to. Don't be afraid to ask for help. The other thing is, and to each their own, but find out what really matters to you in a very odd sense. And it sounds odd, but it's also very simple. And it makes sense to me, is that I kind of have that itch that I needed to scratch in terms of knowing certain things about music. And I got there and I knew myself enough to say, great, I accomplished what I wanted to accomplish. And then I knew myself further to say, I don't want to do this. So know yourself, know what's going to truly make you happy, and go after it. I mean, I don't know if that's too generic, but
that's fine.
I think it's really important to know thyself, know what's going to make you happy and fulfill you, because we're all wired differently. And two sides. Just because you went to music school doesn't mean you have to do music, number one. Or you might choose to. But there's just so much flexibility out there. And I would really say the important thing for those perhaps not going into music is you got the piece of paper. And you show that you can commit to something and finish it. But after that, after you graduate, it really is kind of another reset. You might have grade school, high school as another reset, then college as a reset. When you go into the workforce, it's an entirely new reset. So it's a blank slate, and you have the ability to try stuff out and flounder. And I think that's natural, whether it's 6 months or it takes a few years and you try this. I'd say if you try something and you realize you don't like it, you achieve something. So I don't know. I think it's keeping proper perspective, and I really, to me, it all comes back to networking, because that's all the good things that have ever happened in my life have in some way been attributed to networking.
Gotcha. Oh, Cass, just going back, how did you get that initial part-time job at Berkeley that ultimately led you to your career?
Family friend.
There you go.
Yeah, I truly mean that, and I would encourage our own alumni in general to heed, quote unquote, you know, heed the call or do whatever you can if someone asks for help, because obviously there might be some people trying to find their way, and oftentimes they just need to be pointed in the right direction.
Sure. Hey, let's focus that question in just a little bit more, because right, you're going to go into the index. It sounds like you did glance at other berkeleygrads.com and noticed how people were all interviews linked by what field they were in.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll be there in, you know, business to business sales. Eventually I might break that into subcategories, but not today.
Yeah.
So point is, the people clicking on this interview are the ones who are perhaps thinking about that as a possible career.
Sure.
So for people who are like, hey, you know, the money's good, I get to talk to people, like I could do this, this would be fun. Like, what advice do you specifically have for them?
For seriously wanting to get into...
Yeah, for people who are like, hey, this whole, like, software sales thing sounds cool. Sign me up. How do I do this?
Yeah, I'd say a lot of people start out as a BDR, so don't be afraid to do that. And I'll say up front, a BDR, anybody who's ever been a BDR or a job similar to BDR, I have the utmost absolute respect. I've mentored BDRs before. It is some of the toughest work you could ever do, It's kind of a rite of passage. Don't get discouraged. There's a method to the madness and why a lot of people start that way. So that's number one. BDR, business development representative, or that is your prototypical entry-level job in sales. Mm-hmm. So organizations will always typically have openings for that particular position because, frankly, it's high burn rate. Within 6 to 12 months, you're either going to be found and said, oh, this person knows what they're doing. Let's promote them to sales, or they burn themselves out. And that's just the reality of it. If you can bypass that, great. But I do think there's value in experiencing that. Prepare for a lot of no's, too. I call it collecting the no's. If someone says no to you, great. You know something definitive versus before when you were calling them and wondering. I would say the nice thing about sales is it's from an entry perspective, you'll meet people of all shapes, sizes, and backgrounds. It's not all rosy. There's a lot of hard work into it. But if you use a lot of common – sales also is a lot of common sense. I think the hardest part is the beginning. If you can just – I remember my first year of doing it full time. I was sort of terrified, like, oh, my gosh, I don't know if I can do it. But once you understand the norms and once you understand the industry and once you get a taste for it, I think there's this this point that you get beyond it where it's like, wow, this is actually a profession. And I take a lot of pride in it, and it's viable, and it can serve you well. So I guess my ultimate advice would be if you're interested in it, your door should be able to open because there's not one walk of life that people are looking for. You might have to go entry level, and that's fine. That's probably, in my opinion, going to be one of the hardest, most monotonous jobs you do, but there's a reason for it, and follow through and put your full effort into it. And hopefully if you know, you do that, you're rewarded with becoming an account manager, an account executive, or whatever title they want to give you, and you get to experience it. The good news is it's a fairly easy entry point, and the better you get, the more opportunity you sort of get in terms of typically who you can work with and who you can call on. So it's really good from a meritocracy perspective as well. That's, I guess, one of the other things I really like about it. It is truly kind of a meritocracy. You get out of it what you put in to a certain extent.
Sure. All right, I just have one last question for you, which is, you have the mic, and you're being recorded. So is there anything else you'd like to say? Anything we missed?
No, I mean, that was pretty thorough. I would just say, you know, if you're considering exploring a career in sales, and again, that's a nebulous topic. So you could do sales in from a music perspective, right? You can do that, or you can do something from software in music. I'd say it's worthwhile. I think it's a valid, viable profession. And if you're curious about it, there's a fairly easy entry point. So you should be able to achieve that. And I'd say go for it. It's been incredibly rewarding for me. I'm thankful for it. And I think sometimes it might get a bad rap, kind of like the concept of the way sometimes people stereotypically talk about a lawyer or something like that. But it truly is, it can be very rewarding when done right. And if you're interested, the best way to experience it is to do it. So find an opportunity and go for it.
Gotcha. All right. Well, hey, I really enjoyed this conversation, Brian.
Yeah, thanks, Kevin, for having me and reaching out to me. If there's any follow-up questions you have or anything, feel free to reach out to me, or anybody listening to this, feel free to reach out to me on LinkedIn.
That's very nice of you. And actually, yeah, you can expect to see a message from me in the near future.
Okay, so, great.
All right, well, hey, best of luck to you and everything, and have a great evening.
Great. Thanks, Kevin. Take care.
You too. Bye.
All right, bye-bye.